This is The Way We Connect, exploring the way we date, relate, and communicate. I'm Gwyneth Jones, or Gwen. So how's your sex life going? I was quite excited recently after I'd interviewed Emily Nagoski on the last episode, author of Come As You Are. She recommended this podcast to a friend of hers, so I received an email saying, hey, I'd love to come on your podcast to talk about magnificent sex. So I looked into the book and the author, Peggy Kleinplatz, who has been researching what makes sex amazing and magnificent for, I think, the majority of her career. So what does make sex amazing? Usually we think about, you know, hot tips in Cosmo, right? Or what position, or what, you know, special underwear can I wear? At least that's what I used to think way back when I was a young, impressionable teenager and I used to read magazines like 19 and Cosmo when I was way too young to be thinking about these things. But as many of you may have discovered or not, those are not really the things that make sex worth having. So I talked to Peggy and delved into her research, her book, and what really makes for magnificent sex.
So, hi.
Hello. Thank you for having me today.
You're welcome. So, would you mind introducing yourself a little bit for everybody who's listening?
Sure. My name is Peggy Kleinplatz. I'm a professor in the Faculty of Medicine at the University of Ottawa, and I'm the director of sex and couples therapy training here as well.
Great. So, you got in touch with me after I interviewed Emily Nagoski on a previous episode. So you were telling me about your new book. Can you start by just giving me a little introduction to what that's all about?
Sure. The book is called Magnificent Sex, Lessons from Extraordinary Lovers. It just came out from Routledge. And it summarizes 15 years worth of empirical research the Optimal Sexual Experiences Research Team of the University of Ottawa have conducted since 2005. Now, I would normally tend to think of empirical research as something kind of dry, but given that we're studying hot sex, not so dry.
So how did you come to study sex or magnificent sex specifically?
Well, I've been teaching human sexuality since 1983 at the University of Ottawa, and in 2004, there was this undergraduate student who kept on raising her hands whenever I was presenting research, and she'd say, well, here's what it says in Cosmo. Here's what it says in Maxim. Here's what it says in Vogue. Here's what it says in GQ. And she kept on challenging everything that I was saying. And eventually I came to know her and her keen academic sensibilities. She was, in fact, studying bees.
Bees?
She was one of those hard science types. Then one day she got one bee sting too many, became allergic, and could no longer continue bee research. Long story short, that's how she came to be Dana Menard, the undergraduate student, who then turned into Dr. Menard, who did her PhD in this area with me. She actually did her master's with me on what it takes to make sex great, and then her PhD on what are the factors that lead into making sex magnificent.
Wow. So I want to just ask, what are the typical cliche questions people always ask you when you tell them what you do?
They'd say, oh, great sex, that's great orgasms, right? You'd say, no, not so much. Or, that's the stuff you see in porn, right? No, definitely not. I mean, porn is very entertaining fiction, but it is fictional. It's every bit as fictitious as children's fairy tales. And just like children's fairy tales, they make you believe that dreams can come true, but these are dreams, and grown-ups generally recognize that fairy tales are mere fantasies, but not to be confused with real life.
Yeah, you mentioned in the beginning of your book the damage that porn does to our ideas about what great sex really is. So can you say a bit more about that?
Yes. So in porn, everything looks easy. It looks effortless. There are no children running around. There are no interruptions unless it's somebody dropping by for a threesome. The reality of sex, let alone magnificent sex, is that to make it interesting, to make it desirable sex, one needs to put effort into it, which is exactly the opposite of what we see in porn. In porn, not only is it effortless, everything looks, and I will put this in quote, natural and spontaneous, unquote. The reality of what we've discovered in our research on magnificent sex is that in order to go from ordinary sex to sex worth wanting, it does require considerable effort. Surely not work, but effort in order to make it magnificent.
Why do you think people are so, I don't know, interested in this idea of great sex? Do you think it's a longing for something that they can't name, or is it more that feeling of, oh, everyone else is doing it and, you know, porn tells me it should be this way?
Oh, definitely the latter. People walk around feeling inadequate as sexual beings, maybe stronger than that. They feel defective. They see what's in porn and they see what's described on the web, and for that matter, in magazines, and are sure that they're not keeping up with the Joneses, that their sex lives are not nearly as exciting or fulfilling as everyone else's. And it really does a number on their sense of self. So they're always trying to be something that they're not, not realizing that the pathway towards magnificent sex is greater authenticity, is being more of who you really are, rather than trying to be something you're not. It's not about living up to some externally driven standard. It's about being emotionally naked, authentically who you are, undisguised.
And I'm sure that's kind of a big shock for people when they first hear that, right? Like emotional vulnerability when we're told that the way to impress people that we want to sleep with is to lie and trick them into wanting us.
Yes, I mean, everybody is sure that the secret to great sex is tips and tricks and techniques, and it's not. It's being who you are and being willing to reveal that nakedly.
So tell me a bit more about the book. So who is it aimed at? Like, who did you write it with in mind?
Well, in order to answer that question, I need to go back a step. Mm-hmm. As a sex therapist, the most common problem that I see and that all sex therapists see in our offices are problems related to desire or frequency. That is, people complaining that their frequency is too low, that their partner's desire is too low, and what we call sexual desire discrepancy. That is, when one person's desire is higher than the other's to the point where it's creating conflict for the two people and distress in the relationship. So one of our objectives in writing this book is to make a case that a lot of the sex that people are having is frankly dismal, lackluster, not compelling. And that sometimes low desire, rather than being evidence of some kind of mental illness or physical problem, is evidence of good judgment. So we wrote this book to say, wait a minute, instead of sex therapists trying to treat problems of low desire, maybe we should affirm that it makes sense not to go clamoring for sex that isn't yet irresistible. And that we have the data that shows how to create sex that is worth wanting. So this book is written for our fellow therapists, our fellow academics, but mostly the book is intended for anybody who wants to enhance the quality of their erotic intimacy.
It's very interesting. So what you're saying in kind of, if I could say in layman's terms, is, you know, it might not be that your partner has a low sex drive. It might be that you're not giving them an offer they can't refuse.
Well, that sounds almost as if I'm blaming the person who is after sex when the partner isn't. I'm saying to both of them, maybe it's worth your while to invest in enhancing your sex life so that for the two of you, the sex becomes so enlivened that all you want is to spend more time in one another's embrace. And that surely the person with the higher desire doesn't simply want the partner to say, okay, I'm really tired, but I'm willing to do you this favor. All right, just a minute. Let me see if I can psych myself into this. No, that's not what most of us want. Most of us don't want mercy sex. We want to feel that our partners really want to be with us. And Dr. Minera and I are saying, yes, there are ways of creating sex of that caliber so that both people are really anticipating it, savoring the possibilities of what's ahead.
So you mentioned that this comes from 15 plus years of research, right? So how is your research conducted?
I'm so glad you asked. When we began, we realized that this research was going to have to be somewhat different from most psychological research. Most psychological research is conducted on students taking introductory psychology, which is pretty much the most popular course of any university in the world. And that means we would have to study people who are 20 years old. It occurred to us that 20-year-olds really haven't learned that much about magnificent sex. So we thought, who would know? Who should be the participants in our studies? And for many years as a sex therapist, it had become obvious to me that some of the people, some of my clients who were having really amazing sex, didn't start out that way. They were couples who were going along just fine, nothing fantastic, nothing terrible, but something had happened in their lives. Perhaps one of them became ill or suffered a disability or simply aging had taken place. And what this required from them was creativity. How am I going to solve the fact that my erections no longer occur spontaneously? Or how am I going to deal with the fact that I'm taking medications for my heart disease that now affect my ability to become aroused? And it was their creativity that struck me. Their unwillingness to just say, okay, my sex life is over, but rather to say, how can I make it even better than before? So what I learned from that was, I think I'd like to interview old people, people in their 60s, 70s, and 80s, who been in relationship with each other for at least 25 or 30 years to see how they are making things better and better. So we went recruiting for different categories of people. One of them were these old married people who self-described as having really remarkable, wonderful, memorable, great sex to see what their secrets were. And then it also became obvious that part of what prevents really wonderful sex is the heteronormative box that so many people live in for their whole lives. So we thought we would also interview sexual minorities, so LGBTQ people, Will your listeners know that, or should I explain what LGBTQ stands for?
I hope they will know.
Good. Okay. As well as other kinds of sexual minorities. So people into BDSM or kink, people who are into consensual non-monogamy. Pretty well any kind of sexual minority you can imagine we interviewed. And we interviewed everybody for anywhere from 45 minutes to over 2 hours. And we asked them all kinds of questions, starting with what is it that makes it great for you? And how did you get there? And how did you learn to get there? And we spent many years doing the interviews and then transcribing them and then rating them to uncover their secrets.
Cool. I see in your book there were 8 components of magnificent sex that you identified.
There were 8 major things that we found virtually universally among the old married people, the young LGBTQ kinky non-monogamous people. And they included, well, the 2 things I would say that were probably the most interesting in some ways to juxtapose were being completely embodied in the moment, utterly absorbed in sensations and in being with the other person. So the second major component was the connection with the other, the alignment, the attunement, the merger. And psychologists rarely write about this well. It's the poets who do it well, the songwriters who talk about 2 hearts that beat as one. So if you put those together, those are actually not easy skills to have at the same time. It's not that difficult to be present, to be focused, to be embodied if you're sitting alone in a meditation class or yoga class. But to be utterly absorbed within while completely connected with another human being, that's much harder. To be present within while also being completely aligned with another person so that you can't tell where your skin ends and another person's skin begins. That's really interesting for people to be able to do both of those things at the same time. But there were also other components, including the other that I mentioned previously, authenticity, as well as communication. Now, this is not the ordinary communication that people typically learn about in couples therapy, where couples are often taught the skills of active listening. No. I mean, active listening will get you to adequate sex, but I don't know how many people want sex to be merely adequate. The participants we studied were black belt communicators. They spoke vividly. They spoke articulately. They were downright eloquent, and they touched the same way. These were people who communicated using touch so as to really feel into the other person's space metaphorically and to penetrate metaphorically and literally at the same time. And they allowed themselves to be touched so as to be felt. If you're wondering what I mean by that, I can elaborate.
Sure, tell us more.
Picture yourself the last time you went to your physician's office knowing you were about to undergo something that was not going to be fun, a flu shot, or some kind of medical procedure that you were not looking forward to. The odds are pretty good that in a moment like that, your whole body tenses so that all that anyone can feel while touching you is every muscle in your body is tight. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
Now, picture yourself being touched by someone that you trust implicitly, where you let everything in your body be open so that you can be felt, so so that someone really can feel not just your skin, but what's going on inside of you. So one of these eight components is extraordinary communication. In the words that are spoken, in the words that are received, in the way that touch is given, and in the way that we allow ourselves to be known through a lover's caress. So those are just a few. I'm happy to tell you more of them if you'd like.
So yeah, from looking through them and listening to you speak, you know, the themes that came up were just this idea of trust and connection and, yeah, as you said, authenticity, right? And yeah, like you said, it's completely different from what Cosmo said, which is like, oh yeah, do this position or use this sex toy or these superficial things, right?
Yeah, no, this is the opposite. This is making oneself vulnerable, allowing oneself to surrender emotionally, intellectually, spiritually, physically, just letting your body go, but with another person. Mm-hmm. It's as if two people are taking risks together. And that's very much in contrast to most of my field, where when we talk about risk taking, we're talking about how do you avoid bad things? How do you avoid unwanted pregnancies? How do you avoid sexually transmitted infections, sexual assault? Yeah, there's all the bad risk stuff. But we're talking about surrendering to taking good risks, taking emotional and interpersonal risks with someone who's worthy of your trust. It's one of the phrases we heard often was, it's like jumping off a cliff while holding hands with another person. Surrendering to a journey together.
And do you think it's harder for younger people to do that? Because it sounds like, obviously, these people you interviewed had long-standing, deep relationships, right? Where the trust was really embedded.
Well, it's not even that it's harder or not harder. But one of the questions that we asked everybody was, you know, how did you come to be having great sex? Have you been this way all your life? What were your first sexual experiences like? When did you begin to have sex of this caliber? And they all laughed and said, when I was in my teens, I thought getting laid was really great. When I was in my 20s, I thought having sex without my parents walking in was really great. When I was in my 30s, I thought having sex without my kids walking in was really great. And then in my 40s, I started to think, is that all there is? Is this as good as it gets? And then by their 50s, they'd finally reached the point where they were willing to find the stuff that dreams are made of within. So when we asked them, has your perception of what makes sex great changed over time? They said, yes, I have considerably higher standards now than I did when I was in my teens. I thought that was great. Couldn't compare to what I'm having now. So when we asked, you know, what did it take for you to reach the point at which you began to have really magnificent sex in midlife? Everybody gave us the same answer. The first thing I had to do was unlearn everything I'd learned about sex growing up, and that took a few decades.
Ah, isn't that always the way? Life is a long process of unlearning.
Absolutely. But that's the good news. I mean, some people think, you know, either you've got it or you don't. And these lovers were telling us, no, great lovers are not born, they're made. And if they're made by unlearning everything that we learned that was sex negative while growing up, that means that everybody has the choice. Do you want to spend the rest of your life the way you are right now? Or do you want to shed what you are already walking around in and blossom into something new?
Maybe I wanted to ask you, what do you think are the barriers to having magnificent sex? And I know we've talked about, you know, the messages we receive, right, from porn or from Cosmo about what it should be like?
Well, one of the big sets of myths is, as I mentioned earlier, sex should be natural and spontaneous. And everybody in my office says to me, I don't understand, you know, early on in our relationship, it was all so easy. And then as time went by, it got harder and it didn't seem so natural anymore. And I've read that we should be having date nights, but date nights seem so unromantic. Well, that's the point at which I have to start unpackaging some of their beliefs. And I say, well, when you were first dating, where did you live? And they didn't live together. I said, well, was it really so natural and spontaneous? What did you do to prepare when you were dating? Well, nothing. We just fell into each other's arms every time we saw each other. I said, right, but you didn't see each other every day. You saw each other probably on weekends and maybe a weeknight or two. And I'm willing to bet that when you came home from school or from work when you were first dating, knowing that your new partner might be coming over, you hid all the laundry under the bed and you shoved all the dishes away so that your house didn't look like a mess. And they'll say, yeah. I say, and not only that, when you came home from work, you probably took a shower and shaved or groomed or put some product in your hair or some cologne on or some perfume and threw away the graying underwear with the loose elastics that you'd been wearing while working out at the gym. And after your shower, put on something that made you feel not just presentable, but sexy. Your black underwear or your black lingerie or whatever. And you texted your partner a few times during the day at work so that you'd primed the pump, so that you'd spent the day preparing. And the idea that it was ever natural and spontaneous was a very cleverly hidden illusion. And now that the two of you are living together or married, you can't hide the effort. And that seems somehow unromantic. We need to redefine romantic in terms of, I value you. I value our relationship. I treasure having sex with you enough so that you're going to see all the effort I put in to making this special for you, even though we've been together for a year, 10 years, 50 years. So one of the first things that acts as a barrier is the set of beliefs people have about what sex should look like. And no, it's not natural and spontaneous. And no, it's not about setting up a date night where you need candles and lingerie and roses. No, it's about putting the kind of preparation into yourself and into keeping the relationship emotionally connected so that you have the foundations for what looks natural and spontaneous, but isn't and never was.
Now, I also was wondering about, you know, is it possible to have magnificent sex outside of a committed relationship without, you know, that level of trust and, yeah, vulnerability being a naturally occurring thing?
Whether you know it or not, those are actually two different questions, and I'd like to take them apart if that's okay.
Yeah, for sure.
So, no, it's not possible to have magnificent sex without trust. But trust is not naturally occurring. And for some people, that trust needs to be built up slowly over the course of a long period in an intimate relationship. For other people, that trust happens relatively quickly with the right person. So, for example, among our older married lovers in their 60s, 70s, and 80s, about half of them were in consensually non-monogamous relationships. So that even though the very best sexual experiences of their lives were with their primary partner, having discovered that capacity for erotic intimacy within themselves and with their partner, it's as if the skills were transferable and they were also able to find it with other people. So some of the most poignant interviews we had were with people who had contacted us saying, well, I see here you're looking to interview people in their 70s, like me, who were married for 50 years, which I was, but my wife has died, or my husband has died, and I wasn't ready to give up on my own sex life yet. So here in the nursing home, I've been able to find the people with whom I have that spark, and I can tell relatively quickly, because I'm so attuned to what's happening within me, who are the people around me who I should trust. And I've been able to have that same type of connection, that same type of trust with other people, even though we don't have a 50-year relationship. We've barely had a 50-hour relationship. But yeah, I am capable of having that with other people.
So trusting yourself enough to trust your judgment, really, in other people. So, yeah, there was a really nice part of the book I saw where you mentioned how people's way of being will determine the quality of their relationships and therefore their sex lives. So can you tell us more about that?
Yes. So there's this big argument in the couples therapy world about what's the right way to have a really fulfilling relationship. Some people say it's about being safely attached and secure. And only then can you have a relationship in which people based in trust can have a fulfilling relationship. And other people say, no, it's the other way around. What's required in order to have a fulfilling relationship is for each individual to be so mature, so autonomous, so personally well-developed that they therefore are free to connect with other people. And this is quite the debate in the couples therapy literature. Is it personal maturity or is it relationship security? And the answer is yes. It's not this or that, it's this and that. Think of it as two different pathways. For some people, it's that the security in the relationship gives people the freedom to be themselves, and that in turn leads to magnificent sex. Whereas for other people, it's the same elements, but in the other sequence. It's, I am so comfortable within, I'm so comfortable with my sexuality that I make it safe for you to trust. It's okay to be yourself with me. And that, in turn, leads to magnificent sex. So although the pathways are different, the view from the top of the mountain is identical.
So what would be... I'm just thinking for somebody who's listening now and is thinking, wow, this sounds great, but I don't know where to begin on this journey. Yeah, what kind of things do you normally advise? Are there any kind of exercises or things that you recommend to your clients?
Well, there's a long answer and a short answer. Let me tell you a bit first about how our research progressed, if that's okay.
Yeah.
As you know, our first study was what are the components of magnificent sex? And then we did several others. For example, what are the factors that help to bring it about? And are there differences between the different groups, the men and the women, the young and the old, the able-bodied versus the disabled, the LGBTQ versus the straight, and so on. And interestingly, at least to us it was very interesting, there was no difference among all the groups. And we have so many stereotypes that men and women are really different from each other. That might or might not be true with bad sex. I don't know, because I don't study bad sex. But when it comes to great sex, there are no differences between men and women. There are no differences between the LGBTQ and the straight. There are no differences between the people into BDSM versus the vanilla folk. So we presented study after study in professional conferences for about a 10-year period. And our colleagues, being rather skeptical, would say, well, that's very interesting, but does it have any utility? Are you just telling us about some extraordinary individuals, these lovers you've studied, or does it have any practical value? And we said, well, that's an empirical question. We'd have to research it. So we did. We decided to spend the next 5 years figuring out, are there things that we've learned from these extraordinary lovers who are having magnificent sex that could be applied to help ordinary couples or even couples in distress because of low desire or no desire, low frequency or no frequency, and sexual desire discrepancy. And we developed a whole psychotherapy approach that we now offer to couples and have been doing that since 2013. And in the last chapter of the book, we describe a bit about that, and that we've now proven that yes, the nuggets that we'd gleaned from studying extraordinary lovers can be applied in group therapy to couples who are struggling. And we have a website, optimalsexualexperiences.com, where people can go and find a therapist near them and join a group for people who are struggling. And we have the evidence that working at this can actually enhance the quality of one's erotic intimacy so as to create sex that is irresistible. But it's not a question, again, of tips or tricks. It is concerted effort into one's own personal development and into the relationship, as well as creating the time and space that are not easy to organize if you've got two kids, two jobs, a house to clean. You know, sometimes I wonder if it was easier for people in their 60s, 70s, and 80s because they mostly weren't running around after little kids. Some of them were retired. Maybe that's part of what makes it easier. But the lesson for all of us is the first thing you have to do is decide, do I want this? And if you do, it will mean putting in time and effort. And that's a good thing, not a bad thing.
Yeah, I think it's one of the symptoms of the world we're living in, right? Where people want quick tips or like a formula to just...
Yeah, I mean, let's face it. Once you're sort of sexually proficient with your partner at figuring out how to get each other off, you know how to do it. And a lot of people are willing to settle for that. And I'm not surprised that that's not great. I mean, McDonald's knows how to make hamburgers, right? You're in Zagreb. I'm in Canada. I presume if you walk into a McDonald's, pretty rare anywhere in the world, you're going to get a hamburger that will be roughly similar, if not outright identical. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
But if I were to wander around Zagreb and ask around, people would surely say to me, well, if you want really fine dining, there's a restaurant known to the locals. And if you walk into that place, that won't be like the hamburgers at McDonald's. It'll be distinctive. And the food there was created by gourmets who are interested in not just taste, but in melding the right combinations of herbs and spices and ingredients so that before you even taste it, you can inhale the effort that went into creating something that was spectacular. And you walk in and you see the decor was designed to create a certain style of ambiance. And you look at the dishes and you see that they were plated beautifully. So that you're tempted even before you taste it by the smells and by the sights. And all of your senses are alive when you walk into Just the Right Restaurant. And Just the Right Restaurant was not created by the people who churn out hamburgers at McDonald's. I say this with no offense intended for McDonald's. I'm a vegetarian. I've actually never been to a McDonald's. So I'm giving you an analogy saying to make anything wonderful in life, it takes effort. I mean, any child can go plink, plink, plink on a piano, but to create a beautiful piece of music takes years and years and years of practice to make it extraordinary. So the first thing we tell everybody is, are you sure you want this? Are you sure you want to create something worth wanting? And some people are entitled to say, well, I'm happy to read about it, but no, I don't really think that's for me. And other people might say, yes, this is what I've dreamt of all my life. And I'd like to learn more, more about myself, more about my partner, more about what it takes to make sex worth wanting.
Yeah, and you mentioned, I think it's, you know, it's a really good reflection, right, that maybe the older people had more time, less kids running around or distractions. So I'm just wondering, is this like fine dining in the way that it's kind of a privileged thing that not everyone can access if they're, you know, if they're really stressed and busy and have a bunch of kids at home?
Well, it's not that they can't. It's that it will take considerable effort. So that it might mean that occasionally you have to get a babysitter. Or, I mean, I speak to couples who can't afford a babysitter. And every once in a while, they'll switch with a neighbor. I'll take care of your kids this weekend. You take care of my kids this weekend. And we'll take turns so that the two of you can have time to yourselves, and then some other weekend, the two of us can have time to ourselves. So it's not that it can't be accessed, but it takes a little more ingenuity and creativity to create the space where it becomes possible.
So, yeah, wanting to go back to some of the different elements that you mentioned of magnificent sex. You know, you mentioned, and I think hopefully by now it's kind of clear to people, but just in case it isn't, you talk about how, for example, you know, whether or not you orgasm, it's not really important. Because I know a lot of people get really hung up on these things, right? Like, oh no, am I normal if I don't come? Can you, yeah, tell us more about that?
Absolutely. If anything, ask yourself the obvious question. Have there not been times when you have orgasms and afterwards you found yourself sort of pausing and saying, was that it? That was like, and it was over. Orgasms are not sufficient to make sex great. In fact, they're not even necessary. So many of the people that we interviewed, when we asked, what is the role of orgasm in your best sexual experiences? They said, you know, you can have really great sex without an orgasm, and you can have an orgasm. Most people do most of the time they have sex, and it doesn't make it great. So orgasms are neither necessary nor sufficient. In fact, I can go further than that. I can say, normal sexual functioning is neither necessary nor sufficient for magnificent sex. we spoke to people with all kinds of disabilities who really had to struggle, did not have quote unquote normal sexual functioning, and yet were able to attain magnificent sex because they opened their hearts and their minds to imagination, to doing things differently. If anything, what all the interviews taught us was that you are not going to find your way to magnificent through any path unless you first get out of the mindset that says, am I normal? Am I having sufficient orgasms? Am I keeping up with the Joneses? You're going to need to let go of that whole way of thinking in order to find out what makes sex extraordinary for you. It's the heteronormative box that keeps people having sex that may be functional, may be dysfunctional, but either way is boring, lackluster, dull.
And by heteronormative books, you mean this idea that, like, oh, sex means putting a penis in a vagina, like this basic kind of limiting thought about it?
Precisely. To the extent that you think you know what sex is and that you know how to get from point A to point B or to fit tab A into slot B, you're done. You're going to have to start thinking, what do I want sex to look like in my life? You're going to have to revision sex itself before you get to the point where sex becomes magnificent for you. And then you're going to have to be willing to communicate about it transparently with your words and with your touch.
And it's like expanding our definition of what sex is, right? I think to a form of maybe sexual connection rather than, I don't know, sexual intercourse.
Yes, I mean, picture the person who's lying there in bed while, for example, her partner's on top of her, thrusting in and out and in and out and in and out. Well, what's going on between her ears is, did I remember to start the laundry? Oh, yes, I put the laundry in the machine. Did I remember to put it in the dryer? Oh, no. Does this mean my clothes will need ironing? I mean, technically, she's engaged in intercourse, but she's not having a sexual experience at all. Her body may even respond. He may be hard. She may be wet. But there is no connection. There is no aliveness. They're not engaged, let alone with each other.
And what I talked about with Emily on the previous episode was the huge role that stress plays, right, in putting on the brakes for sexual desire, like how hard it is to really be present and authentic if you're too busy worrying about other things.
Oh, Emily Nagoski is fantastic. And the book that she wrote with her sister, Burnout, is amazing. For your listeners who haven't read it, I strongly recommend you read Burnout and look at the role that people who are constantly pushing themselves too hard and feeling inadequate about not finishing their to-do list each day, how that can affect one's ability to just be in the moment, which is a prerequisite for having magnificent sex. To the extent that you're constantly stressed out, magnificent sex is impossible.
So learning to be in the moment more. And what would you say to advice like, you know, start a mindfulness practice, start meditation, or, you know, some way of bringing yourself into the moment in day-to-day life?
It depends. The devil is in the details. So for many people, they take a mindfulness class and they've learned how to focus on what's happening within while they're alone in a class. The people we interviewed were not doing the kind of mindfulness that you could acquire in a weekend mindfulness workshop. I mean, mindfulness comes to us from ancient religious disciples who made mindfulness a lifetime's discipline, not something you acquire in a day or a weekend or even a year or two. So the level of being completely absorbed in the moment, such that you're making love and you wouldn't notice if somebody dropped an atom bomb, is way, way, way higher than the level of mindfulness that's being taught in most mindfulness classes. So it's not that there's anything wrong with mindfulness, but I'd be very careful about how I'm defining mindfulness.
Yeah, yeah. So it's one thing to meditate in a quiet, peaceful room, right? And another to focus when everything is chaotic around you.
Or get rid of the chaos, but can you acquire the level of embodiment, not so much mindfulness, but embodiment, so that you can be fully absorbed within your own skin while fully engaged with another person? Mm-hmm. And together, the two of you shut out the rest of the world.
There's a lot of great stuff to look at there. And I definitely think, you know, your book is really fascinating as well, in terms of looking into this. So,
Thank you.
You're welcome. Is there anything else you'd like to add here at the end?
It's been one of the great privileges of my life to do these interviews with my colleague, Dr. Menar, co-author on this book. And these individuals were so fully alive, I'm not surprised that they were also fully alive when it came to their sexuality. But whereas these people were extraordinary, it is important to remember that none of them started out that way. That the words that we quote so extensively in this book suggest that each one of them chose a journey towards personal and interpersonal development, and they give us insights into how any of us can begin such a journey. Each path will be unique, but the empirical answer to, is this just some extraordinary lovers, or could this apply to anyone? The empirical answer is, it's not just for a few unusual individuals. Anyone who wants to undertake this kind of journey can enhance their sex lives. And we're hoping that the words of our participants throughout the book can be of benefit to people who would like to undertake that journey.
Thank you. And thank you for talking to me today.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It's been a pleasure.
What I really love about not just this interview, but seemingly most interviews that I've had on this podcast in the last few months, is that everything comes back to the same few things. It comes back to self-love, you know, to connecting authentically with yourself, accepting yourself for who you are, not feeling guilt or shame or self-loathing. And then that in turn just makes us connect far more deeply and authentically to the people in our lives. And that, you know, from what Peggy was saying, and from what many of you might know, that is the key to deep, authentic connection, which is going to lead to far better sex than if you're doing it for a different purpose. So, of course, it's worth noting the people that were involved in the research, and it could well be that, you know, if we asked a bunch of people in their 20s what makes sex amazing and worth having, we're going to get very different answers. But I find this research and this book very inspiring. You know, the people that were interviewed, the different demographics and the different answers, it just seems to come from very beautiful and loving place, talking about sex as something far, far beyond, you know, the positions, the technicalities of what's actually happening physically, but making it far more about the depth and beauty of that connection. So there we go, something for you to think about and mull over while you're maybe at home in quarantine. What makes sex really worth having? And if the sex you're being offered is not worth having, could that not be the reason why you might not be that interested in it? And how can you turn that sex, you know, from something that's just okay into something that's really amazing? So in the link to this post, I'll show you how you can get hold of Peggy's book and find out more about her work. And we will maybe not talk about sex next episode. I know this has been a pretty sex-heavy few months on this podcast. Next time I am going to talk about emotional intelligence and how we can use that to connect more authentically and deeply to ourselves and to each other. So thank you for joining The Way We Connect, and leave a comment, leave a tweet. You know, we're on Twitter at The Way We Connect, on Instagram and Facebook, all at The Way We Connect, or the website's thewaywe connect.org. Come and leave your comments. What makes sex really worth having in your opinion? What do you think of this research, of this book, and is there anything you'd like to add? So I'm Gwyneth Jones, and thank you for joining me today at The Way We Connect.